Hey, what's up, everybody? It is me, Sarah G, with the Smack, and I am back. And today we're going to be talking about one of my favorite topics, the hourly planning model. And so, for those of you that are skeptical, it actually does work. It can work. And I have someone here who's doing awesome with it, my homeboy, Kevin Estes. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, glad to be here, Sarah.
Is great. So, Kevin, let's just start from the beginning. When did you strike out on your own, and why did you set up your firm, Scaled Finance, as an hourly planning practice as opposed to all the other things you could have been doing?
Well, yeah, I am a hard career changer. So this is my encore career. I worked in corporate finance for a really long time in analytics, big companies, T-Mobile, Amazon, other retailers. And I just saw a need. People were asking me in finance. They were coming to me at T-Mobile asking me questions about personal finances. And I figured, wow, if people in finance were having a tough time, imagine folks in marketing or retail store associates or call center agents. So I realized there was a big opportunity here to help people. And so I actually launched, I left T-Mobile at the beginning of 2022. And I started the company soon thereafter. I didn't launch until the following year. So 2023 of April is when I officially launched.
I mean, I think a lot of the new REAs come through XYPN, but XYPN is probably tilted a little bit more towards the AUM model. So why didn't you go in that direction, given what the influences were on you?
So it really came down for me between hourly and AUM. And what I couldn't quite justify was that I realized that a lot of the work with clients is upfront. You got to get to know them, their goals, their dreams, understand all their finances and how it all fits together. That takes time, that takes work. With AUM, however, you're charging based on the assets under management. So at the beginning, you might be running at a bit of a loss, right? Where you're spending a lot of time not making much money. Well, the opposite happens later on, where people are working less perhaps than they were initially, at least on a monthly basis or an annual basis, but they're charging more. And I couldn't quite justify doing less and less and charging more and more over time. It just didn't seem like the right trade-off for me. So instead I said, wow, what if I did hourly and I worked really hard to get people's finances on the rails, right? Invest that additional time with them and them to invest that additional money. But then after that, smaller adjustments in the future. So my intent is that it costs more to start and then it slowly trends down over time as there's less and less that we have to do for them, but they get more benefit because their accounts are growing.
Kevin, let's just pause there for a minute. Let's talk about the psychological effect it has, though, to begin a long-term relationship, charging somebody a large amount of money, larger than is expected over the course of the relationship. Because I think psychologically, that's a challenge for the consumer, no?
It is, and I'll say that it depends on the person. I have a client who has $5 million. For them to charge, for them to pay me $6,000 for 6 months is a screaming deal, because if they were getting charged 1% AUM, it would be substantially more than that for the year. And so, it depends on the person. I find that what I like to do is help people. I think that everybody, well, not everybody, but the vast majority of people could actually manage their investments on their own. And I view it as my duty to help them do that. And so I do some very interesting things. Instead of having lots of different accounts, I work hard to consolidate those to make it easier for them to manage. Instead of having a dozen different investments in one account, I might pare it back to three or two or one. As long as it fits into the overall portfolio from a diversification perspective and it achieves what they're looking to do, it's easier for them to manage. I want to make it simpler for them as opposed to harder.
So you're an hourly financial planner, but you're also what we call in the Transparent Advisor movement advice only.
Correct. Absolutely. I don't touch investments. I think that personally, there's not a lot of benefit to having the assets under me when we know that there's not a lot of alpha out there for people who are actively managing investment portfolios. So it just seems like extra work for the client that doesn't add them any value.
So what Kevin is saying is that he's advice only. He's a planner. He doesn't manage the investments himself. You essentially have them do it. Ken, how do
Correct.
you set that up so that it actually works?
Yeah, and again, just simplicity is the key. The framing, I think, is really helpful here. The way that the industry has focused on this in the past has been, look, we do your you do your investment management for you, right? You don't have to do it yourself. Don't you worry. We'll just take care of it. And I find that a lot of people prefer to manage it themselves. They just need a little help from time to time. It's a little bit like people who have a tough time breathing, right? It might be that they need to stop smoking. It might be that they need to get outdoors more. It's possible they need more exercise or could benefit from, from doing a variety of breathing exercises. An inhaler could help. Not everybody needs a ventilator. And what I do is everything but ventilator.
But what are some of the tangible things that you do when you're handing off the investments to them? How do you make it simpler to them? How do you communicate that? How do you give them the tools that they need to actually do it?
Absolutely. And I think that it's helpful to know where they're coming from to start off with. They're, for the most part, DIYers. These are folks who, I have one pre-client that I've been meeting with. They've been doing it themselves. They've got $900,000 in cash sitting around because they sold a home. They have multiple millions of dollars that they're looking to invest, but they've already done it on their own. So they're looking for assistance in that DIY model, as opposed to, where they're coming from somebody else who is doing it all for them. They've largely done it themselves. And so this is a step in that direction of, okay, you can do it. I can help. And so I go through everything about their financials. So I have a comprehensive financial plan, get all of their information, tax returns and W-2s and all their latest investment statements. And I go through it with them and create kind of strategy for them. So an investment policy statement, like any other advisor would do who's managing assets. As one meeting, get their risk tolerance, know what's going on. And then, as a second meeting, follow up with, okay, and here are the specific recommendations that I suggest. And I'm trying to match, their overall category, their allocations to their ideal. However, I'm doing it with the fewest moves possible, right? Trying to really simplify this. Oh, you're here? This is fabulous. You don't have to touch this account at all. Right. Or wow, you can leave the vast majority of the investment alone in this one account here. However, I'd suggest you maybe tweak a little bit here and sell this, and I'd recommend you buy this. But that's done after a full review of all their documents.
Well, I bet it's really relieving for people to go into a financial advisor expecting a lot of work to be created and expecting things to be complexified and to be talked to in really technical terms and to be made to feel like the world is ending if they don't do all this stuff, all of which comes with a pretty hefty price tag, only to hear that there are adjustments that need to be made, but that some things can actually stay as is. I bet that's a huge relief for them.
Absolutely. And one thing I do, because these folks are coming to me with money, is to just celebrate their wins so far, right? Look, you've done a wonderful job up to this point doing these things here. And I think with some small adjustments, we can really move the needle here. And so I typically have a 6-month process where we meet monthly as I'm bringing on new clients. And that last meeting, that sixth meeting, is typically one that I call financial independence. But I look at what they've been doing, and if they keep saving the way they had been saving before we met, what their trajectory would look like. But then we go through and I layer in one by one each of the recommendations and show the impact of each of them. Turn one on, and I use eMoney as my financial planning software. Turn one on and show the cash flow impacts, show the asset impacts, and then turn it off, and then go to the next recommendation and do that. And then once we go through each one, I turn them all on and say, you were on this glide path. And this is where you might be with all these recommendations. For them, it seems to me like it's empowering. I can't speak for them, but it feels I feel that they're engaged. They also get a chance to get all those questions answered that they've never been able to get answered. So I'll have oftentimes the first meeting, we'll have many recommendations at a high level, and my recommendations are always in a 3-step process, which is I'll make an observation. I'll ask a clarifying question and then I'll make a recommendation. And I'll just do that over and over throughout the conversation. At the end of that call, a lot of people just get really engaged and start emailing me questions. I might get 5, 10 questions after that first real client meeting. We're like, what about this? And what about this? And what about this? And they just never had an outlet to be able to get answers before.
How are you getting these clients?
Super awesome question. Well, I'm pretty specific on my marketing that I'm working with T-Mobile employees and their families. However, about half the folks who are reaching out, if not a little bit more, are non-T-Mobile clients. They resonate with this hourly model, Or, there's somebody who I used to work with at T-Mobile who's moved on to a different company, or they're friends and family members, frankly. I mean, that's how a lot of us get started as friends and family, right? That take a leap of faith with us. And I'll say that it's been wonderful. I think it was six pre-clients reach out between late December and January. It's been busy. My marketing, I think, is working. People say they like what they're seeing on LinkedIn. I'm consistently connecting with people on LinkedIn, about 100 people a week that I'm inviting to connect, and that seems to be driving some business, but it's just really organic, it feels.
What do you do if you get someone who doesn't work at T-Mobile?
It depends on the person. If they are going to be a good fit for a lot of other reasons, then I will take them on. If they're not, I don't think going to be a great fit for my model, then I'll refer them out.
Kevin, what do you see as the challenges of this type of a service model?
It takes a lot of time to set up. And so there's a fair bit of unbillable time. That's one of the things that I'm going to be doing is raising my rate. I was charging $200 an hour, and I'm going to go up to 250 here, hopefully before March 15th. But that's one of the biggest challenges. I don't feel comfortable charging people for setting up their agreements, right? Getting the invoicing set up. There's just some administrativia that I can't charge for, and I don't really want to charge for.
Can you automate that so that it's quicker?
The nice thing is that once I've gotten the templates together, it is faster. It's kind of that first one you have to build that takes the longest. However, after that, I build a roadmap. So I work co-create a roadmap with these pre-clients and clients to say, hey, it sounds like based on our conversation, these are the most important things. And we rank order those topics from top to bottom. My thought as being a fiduciary is that I can't just run people through a factory model, because if I say we always do investments in the first meeting, we do taxes in the second meeting, and we do cash flow in the third meeting, it's possible what they need most is not one of those first three things in somebody's factory model. So instead, mine is much more organic, where I work with them to get a sense of what their pain points really are and go tackle those first. So building the roadmaps, I can't really make much faster because each one is tailored to their needs.
You don't bill them for the time that you take to build a roadmap for their relationship.
Correct, because I don't, I have that as part of the pre-process before they sign on the dotted line. So before they sign the agreement, we say, oh, here's what we're going to work on. I just think that's clear and fair to me. It's tough to sell the invisible. So I just try to make it as tangible as possible before they hop on board.
So this hits on an interesting point because I think that's one of the reasons that people don't do hourly because they feel like, well, what if there's too much of this additional stuff? What if there's too much stuff that I can't bill for? So it's like the transparency, I think, that the hourly model creates is in many cases prohibitive for a lot of advisors psychologically.
I think I agree that it is psychologically prohibitive, and I think it's in our head, frankly. So I track every minute of my day that's not in the bedroom, essentially. And I've never, and I have that in total, and then I have it broken out for each client. I have never had a client ask me for that list. I have it. If they want to see exactly what day and what time I worked on their things and what I did, I have that information.
Yeah,
They
I think you
just,
have to have it for regulatory purposes, right? Yeah.
and I would want that. Like,
Yeah.
that's if that's how I'm billing, I should be able to substantiate it. But with that, I think that clients understand the value. They understand the work that goes into these five-page agendas that I put together for every meeting, and they understand the work that goes into the 10 or 15 pages of notes that I have at the end that I upload to their e-money vault, right? Like, they get what I'm doing. They get that I'm all in for them. They get that I'm treating their money as my own. And because of that, I don't get questioned about my bills, right? I've been super fortunate, knock on wood, so far, is that I'm, only have three clients that are at least 6 months in, and every one of them has signed another agreement.
Interesting because there's a safety that I think people perceive with the 1% model, or even with the idea of charging a flat fee for services on, let's say, a monthly basis, right? So there's like I want to say like opacity there that, that the 1% model can create for people that I think kind of is a shield for them.
And I completely hear that. And it is certainly simpler from a logistical perspective not to have to go create all these different agreements every 6 months, which is what I'm doing. I want my business to pencil every time that they pay me. I view myself as a fiduciary, and my job is to be able to help them improve their lives through their finances. Every dollar that I receive from them, I need to add a multiple of value, is my perspective. And if I don't, then I'm not doing my fiduciary duty.
Amen, bro. Imagine if everybody thought like that. But fiduciary is this kind of moniker that people like to use, and it almost is like a virtue signal a lot of times. And I just want everybody around the world who's listening to this podcast to understand that this is a man who takes this very seriously. And while we can by no means make blanket statements about one model adhering to the fiduciary standard any more than the other one, I know that sometimes we do, but the fact of the matter is it's a personal decision to be a fiduciary. Like to really be a fiduciary, how closely you hold that standard. And it sounds like he's doing a great job here. So awesome. That's an awesome perspective. I wish more people thought like that.
Well, thank you. And I'm not casting stones for other business models. It should be expensive if somebody needs to be on a ventilator. That makes a ton of sense to me. If somebody needs the support, they got to get compensated for it. And for me, the way I've been building my model with education first, I'm going to support you and you're going to do it yourself because you can model. I just couldn't rationalize, again, charging more and more and doing less and less over time.
Well, I think the other thing that's made this model work so well, and as all of you are listening here, you can tell that so far Kevin's done great, is that I think Kevin's a great communicator. So if I could just tell a story about the hourly model. When I first started working with my accountant, it was 4 years ago, I had this bill that I got, and it was like, I mean, it was a lot for, I think, for what he did, I thought. It was just my tax return and it was $2,000. And I was like, what? $2,000 for a tax return? And then after the fact, he's like, that's okay. I can reduce it. I could take it down a little bit, Sarah. Sorry, I didn't mean that to be such a surprise to you, which I don't know. Is that even ethical to do? Like to just reduce like fees after the fact because I complained? Like, how is that really fair to your other clients if you in fact invested this time? First of all, but second of all, if he had told me, look, this is what the setup process is going to be. Because then, after I got the bill and I griped about it, he explained, well, I had to put you in the system. You had this, like, I needed a letter to validate because I was moving and I needed a validation letter of my income, whatever. And I'm self-employed, right? So it's like all these things. If he had said, look, I'm sending you the bill, but I just want to be clear to you, he doesn't itemize, which is the first thing. But second of all, if he had just explained up front, like, look, the first bill is going to be bigger, then I would never say anything.
Right. Yeah, I think that's critical, that framing. Just level setting expectations before you get going is really very important in this, excuse me, in this model. With 1%, it's pretty clear. Hey, here are the assets we're managing at 1%. Yeah, okay, it'll change and adapt over time, but I get it. With hourly, I think I treat it like a project. I'll come in and say, I don't know exactly how many hours this will take. But I think it's going to be between, I'll make it up, $4,000 and $6,000. And if you don't have a lot of complexity, you don't have a lot of questions, it might be more like four. If you do, and I had a client, actually my first client, who I love her, and she has so much complexity and so many, many, many questions that I wanted to help with, that our initial agreement was for 5,000 before 6 months was over, it was 11. Right? That doesn't happen very often. That's not what I want to happen. But she saw value in this. And that's why we created another agreement. She's like, I'm getting the things I need to get answered. You're helping with my business. You're helping me with my rentals. You're helping me with my regular job. You're helping me with all these areas of my life that I've only been able to meet for 2 hours once a year with an advisor ever. And I needed more.
Kevin, how do you actually track the time? Do you just use Excel sheets?
Yes, I don't use Excel because I'm not always around Excel. I put it into Excel at the end, but I just keep it on my phone and just say, okay, I started at this time, I ended at this time, and this is what I did during that time frame. And I just keep doing that throughout the day, and it works out pretty well. It also helps me see things like listening to your podcast. How many hours am I actually working? Well, if I'm walking the dog and listening to the podcast, I'm gonna track that as work. But I might be able to multitask a little bit. I don't do that with clients though. When I'm working on clients, I'm dedicated to clients.
Well, yeah, you have to be if you're charging them for that time, of course. Do
Absolutely.
you conduct any data analysis of your practice data because you track it?
Some. And so I am not yet a certified financial professional or planner professional because I don't yet have the work experience. I just started the business, as we talked about a couple of years ago, and launched it about a year ago. And so I am tracking my hours for for the CFP board requirements. And I have somebody who attests for those, but it does help to be able to see how many hours I'm working, which unfortunately is more than 40 hours a week when you're getting going. And over time, my hope is that that'll stabilize and a higher percentage of my time will be billable as opposed to, marketing and other things that I might be doing right now.
One of the concerns that people have when they work on a project by project basis with clients is how do I get the clients to come back? Because sometimes they come back for it can be episodic. Like sometimes they come back, they do work with you for 3 months, and then you don't hear from them for a year. Or sometimes because it's hourly. I mean, how do you know that they're even going to complete the engagement? If you don't have their assets, so you're not debiting right out of the account.
Nope. Great question. So what I do with new clients is that I bill half up front and half at the end, roughly. Right. So because I don't know exactly how many hours I'm going to spend, I estimate it. And let's say that it was 4 to 6,000 as the example before, I would charge $2,500 up front, right? Before when they sign, they have to sign the agreement and then pay the 2,500 and then we can get started. After that though, it's a bit of a cash crunch if I were to do that again for the next agreement. So 6 months later with people, it just didn't seem right to go charge them again up front because now they're paying the 2,500 or whatever on the back end plus the 2,500 for the next. That's 5 grand out of pocket. That's a lot of money in go. And so what I do instead is say, look, you've paid me. We've had a great working relationship. I invoiced you. Everything's looking wonderful. I'm not going to charge you again right away up front. I'll bill you at the back end of this. Right. And then we can get into a bill in arrears sort of perspective because there's some trust built there. But what I do, Sarah, every time that I am wrapping up that agreement is first off, I try to have that conversation to show them the value of what they've received so far. And so far that's been very well received. The second thing is I'll actually create another agreement and I'll create another roadmap with them and say, I think we need these other things here. And my goal is that the second agreement will be smaller than the first. And my goal is that the third agreement be smaller than the second. And then over time, we get to the point where they're on the rails and they need fewer and fewer adjustments.
Do you for clients that have come and gone, but are expected to come back at some point in the future, do you have a way that you routinely stay in touch with them using marketing communications?
Fortunately, I haven't had that problem just yet. But yes, that most of them are either they joined one of my email lists beforehand and are like, I kind of like this guy. I might work with them. Or they asked to join after they've become clients. And so I add them to those distros. So they're getting my weekly emails. And with that, I'm staying in touch with everybody that way.
But also, I think if they're on your LinkedIn, then they'll see you as long as you're posting updates that are relevant to them and they're seeing you in the feed, they'll keep seeing you in the feed unless they stop for some reason following, right?
Yes, and
LinkedIn
I
can
just,
always serve it up.
it, yeah, that's the algorithm. I don't know how much trust I would have in LinkedIn doing all that all the time for me. And so that's part of the reason why I think it makes sense to see if I can put them in an email list.
Tell you, people do really underestimate the power of email marketing. But even in the with all the social media platforms, people still like newsletters.
Absolutely. And you can be a little bit more personal. I got this feedback this year at FinCon, the marketing conference for financial services. The recommendation was at the top, put in some quick wins and then go into the body of what it is you're talking about. So I often, or every time I do this, I have a post on my website that goes with it that's much longer. It would not fit in an email. And then at the end, I've now started putting in personal bits. Hey, here's what happened this week. Right. And that way I can continue to connect with them on a personal level, even if it is in a one-to-many format.
What would you say to somebody who wants to do this, but is just terrified to death by this scenario. I have a mortgage, I have a spouse, I have kids, and I'm going to wake up on the first of every month with, and when I'm starting up, right? No calls booked. What do you tell somebody?
Well, I'd say the first thing is that if you're first starting out, the people that you tend to attract when you're younger don't necessarily have a lot of assets. So you're going to have fewer assets and you're going to be charged on 1%. They might have $100,000, you're getting $1,000 a year. Well, with this model, I've been super fortunate to average north of six, right? Thousand per 6 months. And so to your point about ramping, it ramps a lot faster on the hourly model. That's part of why I think that a lot of people start off with a project base or an hourly base and then transition over time into the AUM model, because it takes a long time. It takes a very long runway for that 1% to make it pencil. And so I'd say from that perspective, you might grow substantially faster. And I'm well above the benchmarking averages for the first year, and it was a partial year. I anticipate being above the industry benchmarks for the next year as well. Beyond that, just I'd say have faith in yourself. If you're doing real comprehensive financial planning and you're changing lives, they're not going to go anywhere. Particularly if you're going to be charging them less over time, to and you have to work less for them. There's I think a fair bit of stickiness that's underappreciated within this project slash hourly model.
Well, I think that with AUM, it's a straight calculation, right? Well, I know once I get my business up to 10 million, I know once I get my business up to 50 million, 20 million, how much I'm going to be earning. And then I can kind of project out how many years or how long it'll take me to get to that point. But with this hourly kind of a scenario, it's a lot harder because you may have a certain number of relationships, but those relationships are not uniform in the amount of hours. So there's no way to really know until you know what the average amount of hours is that a client engagement is going to take. It's going to be hard to project that revenue.
I think that the longer I go into this, initially it's like, am I gonna get clients, right? And then it's like, okay, I got a client. Was that a fluke? And then second month, okay, I got another client. Actually, I had two the first 2 months, so I had four clients in the first 2 months of getting going. And I was like, oh, is that a fluke, right? And then over time, it's just like, oh wait, now somebody else. Wait, now these two people scheduled meetings, pre-client meetings with me within an hour. Oh my gosh, like I'm getting busy. Right. And so I think that initially it can feel like you're taking a step into the abyss. However, in reality, you're doing good work and people are starting to recognize it. And there's a lot of demand for the hourly model. I'm hearing this from hourly planners as they're getting busy. Right. And so I would say that, yeah, maybe from a napkin math perspective, it's tougher to see. Nonetheless, there's a lot of demand here. And if you treat your clients right, they're going to come back. Right. So it's not like you're starting at square zero. I have wonderful clients and they're the best type of clients because I've already got them set up in the system and it doesn't cost me as much unbillable time. And so I just say that having faith in that in this model and going all in for me has been beneficial.
But going all in also, I think, means making sure that you're doing the very best that you possibly could. And I'm sorry if this sounds like some kind of like motivational Tony Robbins thing, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, how long have I been? My son is 8. I mean, I've been, probably been at this about 8 years now as an entrepreneur, right? Like, and one of the things I can say is that the world will part. The waters will part when you get up and you're like, I'm going to say or do something that's absolutely awesome. I'm going to go with this. And here I sound crazy, right? I sound like I'm on some soapbox here, but I'm sorry, but this is true. Okay. I know this from my own business that there are days that I get up and I'm like, man, I'm so sick of this newsletter I'm sending out getting a 25% open rate. I want to get it up to 50%, but I'm not going to use scummy tactics like clickbait. I'm going to actually like really go deep here. And I'm going to make some strong conclusions and I'm going to think about things a different way, or I'm going to ask questions that I normally haven't asked, or I'm going to do more research, or I'm going to look around, or I'm going to go ask people, what do you find challenging about this particular scenario that I am trying to solve, right? I'm going to do something extra. And when you get up and you say that, things do happen. I mean, you're out there, you get your website, you make it clear how to contact you and what you when you're set up and you go and you do that, the waters do part.
So I look at compensation as a function of value, right? You get a percentage of the value you provide. If you want to get better compensated, help more people or help them more or do both, right? That to me is that's the whole thing. And so how can you do that? If you get stuck, if you're ever in a position where like, oh, I'm not getting any pre-clients, I'm not, gosh, I don't like calling them prospects, by the way, because they're not gold nuggets, right? But I'm not really getting the flow that I want. Well, maybe reach out to your existing clients and just do a double check. Make sure you've done everything you can do for every one of your existing clients, and who knows, you might get a referral out of it, or have a repeat client come on board for another engagement, another roadmap.
What I call the language of familiarity, that when you reach out to somebody that you've known for a while or that you've had a conversation with a while ago, and you'd say to somebody, "I remember when we talked 3 years ago, you mentioned that you have a child that really wanted to go to Rutgers, and I remember that conversation, but you were a little concerned about it. Now that it would be about the time that she's coming to apply. Are you pursuing that? Yes, you are. Okay. Would you be open to sitting down so that we could just discuss some of these themes like the ones we discussed 3 years ago? I'm now a financial advisor. That's a little bit different, right? Something like that, right? The
Absolutely.
language, because nobody does that. And you'd be surprised at how much you can, people will open themselves to you if you take the time to show that you understand them.
Yeah, and care. People do not know they don't care what you know until they know that you care. Right. And so by doing that, by saying, I heard you 3 years ago, you occupy this brain space right here for me, and you are top of mind. And you know what? It's time now, maybe, to talk about that. People will absolutely love you for that, to say, oh, I feel seen. I feel heard.
I feel remembered.
I feel remembered. I feel cared for. All those things.
You
And
thought about
that,
me,
you
right?
thought about me. And it's not this, oh, we sent you a gift, oh, we sent you a holiday card. It's deeper than that. It's much more meaningful. But those really true deep human connections, I believe that's the business here, right? That's what we're doing, is I am helping people live their best lives and change in small ways, make micro adjustments that are going to have an outsized impact on their future. And if something changes, that's every time I have a meeting, every single client meeting I have, I start with two questions. And the first question is, what's on your mind? Because if they have something on their mind and I just go bully through my agenda, they're going to get lost. They're going to be thinking about the thing that was on their mind. That's not going to work, right? So let me pause and just ask. And it could be three, four, five, six, seven things. That's fine, right? And I'll answer those. And it could be half or three quarters of our meeting. That's fine, right? That's by default the most important thing for them. The second thing I always ask is, has anything changed since the last time we spoke? Because at this age, things are changing all the time. All the time. Buying a house, selling a house, getting a new job, getting laid off from the last job, getting another offer, getting that job, getting pregnant. That's all one client that I have right now in 5 months. Things are changing rapidly. So if I pause and I don't go with the machinery and I don't go with the factory model, and I say, I'm going to be more organic, and I'm going to ask about what's on your mind, I'm going to ask about what's changed in your life, I'm really asking about you. I'm making it about you, and I'm trying to deliver you the things you need right now.
So what I'll kind of summarize as I wrap this up here is that I think that Kevin's success as an hourly planner has boiled down to a very focused strategy and niche in working with T-Mobile employees, good communication with clients, good expectation setting. Sounds like you have a good community around you. And it also sounds like you've been re relatively level-headed and strategic about planning out the course of relationships and making sure that the value, that you're always providing value.
That's the goal. That's the goal. If I ever fall short, I like that there's a natural checking mechanism in place where people will say, ah, it's not worth it anymore. Fabulous. Go forth and prosper, right? That's what I want. If it's not a good fit anymore for whatever reason, that's okay, right? And I truly, truly wish you well. You do not have to pay me anymore, and And we're good to go. Sarah, I don't know if we're wrapping up, but if we are, I just want to say I love what you're doing with the fee transparency movement. I love our monthly calls. I'm so looking forward to the immersion. I have learned so much from you and the others in the group. And I truly appreciate where you're taking this industry.
Well, amen. Thank you. I do feel like I've been called, in a sense, to assume this role. And I just am hoping that I can make a larger contribution because I think that there are a lot of people out there that we need to help. And God willing, that's where I'm going to hopefully be taking this. So, all right. Well, thanks everybody for tuning in. Kevin, thanks for your time. And everybody, if you could please rate, subscribe, and review this show, we will see you in the next one.